I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. I thought a lot about this week of what we should talk about. There were actually some disturbing things happening down in Africa, but as Austin can attest, there's always disturbing things happening down in Africa. We just don't, here in the West, cover it as well as we should be. But the Ukraine thing has just bubbled up, and I think for the majority of the population here in the United States, it's probably whacked them upside the head and go, what, Ukraine, Jim? And a lot of them don't understand what that whole thing is about. Now, if they had been reading Strategy Page, they would, because I went back and looked at how long we've been talking about the issues between Russia and the Ukraine, and I think it's almost since we started. But, and that's 15 years ago. But, Jim, how important is the Ukraine to Russia from the standpoint of a historical standpoint from Tsarist Russia and the former Soviet Union?
Well, I mean, historically or emotionally, Ukraine is very important because all Russians, ethnic Russians, acknowledge that Kiev and the area that now encompasses, you know, Western Ukraine is where Russian culture began. That is the Babylonia. You know, that is, you know, ancient Egypt, whatever you want to say. It all came from there and spread north and eventually east and what have you. The problem is that it became a backwater. The economy, the power moved elsewhere. Everything, actually, the deck was really reshuffled when the Mongols marched in. That tends to be overlooked in the West. But it's still important, but not for anything more than emotionally. Economically, not much. Politically, you know, all right, they have 46 million people. I mean, taking Ukraine back into the Russia would basically increase the population by a third. But the Ukrainians always wanted to be independent. And until the 17th century, they were. And now they are again, and as they were after World War I, they feel it's slipping away.
Now, Austin, the Ukrainians have something that's very important to the Russia, and that's the Black Sea ports. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, they've got several things that are important to Russia. Jim just hit on the demographic component, and that really does play a role in it. Ethnic Russians in primarily in eastern Ukraine and in Crimea, the significant ethnic Russian populations. As Jim also talked about the historical importance of it, Kiev and Rus, R-U-S, as Russians see as the origin of the Russian state. They also have significant agricultural capacity, Dan. Don't underestimate the productivity of Ukraine. So there, I'm
right.
Ukraine's
seen as like the Midwest of that area,
well,
right?
It's a breadbasket, literally. And if you that's sometimes it's compared to Kansas, Nebraska, Iowa. It's reasonable. I mean, and reasonable comparison. They are flat too, for the most part, but to get to the Black Sea ports. Now, Crimea has the outstanding seaport on the Black Sea for the Russians, and that's Sevastopol. And the Crimean Peninsula has been a strategic asset. It was something that Peter the Great wanted, Russian czars wanted control over. Nikita Khrushchev gave Crimea to Ukraine, and there were actually some reasonable administrative considerations in running it during in 1954, in time of the Soviet Union. It was cast as an act of brotherly socialism. Now, of course, after the breakup of the Soviet Union and the lost Russian enclaves, and Sevastopol has a large ethnic Russian element, We write a lot about Transnistria. We have in Moldova. When we're covering that, again, when we're doing regular updates on the Balkans, and that's a bit of a model. Yeah, for what has happened with some of these ethnic Russian, enclaves, towns, regions that are no longer part of the Russian state. But Crimea is, Sevastopol is still the home fleet base for the Russian Black Sea Fleet. They have a long-term lease on it. So that's extremely valuable to Moscow.
Right. Jim, bring us up on recent history. I mean, within the last 10 years, what's been bubbling in the Ukraine and the tensions between Russia and the Ukrainians?
Well, everything really started after the Soviet Union fell apart and Ukraine became one of the 14 nations formed from the half of the Soviet Union's population that wanted to be apart. Actually, more people wanted to be away from the Russia, but half of them made it, and the largest group was Ukraine. The Ukrainian economy then collapsed, by and large. Let me put it this way. Ukrainians, especially in Western Ukraine, still see themselves as part of Europe, Western Europe. They've maintained this despite the fact that, you know, they've been part of Russia, the Russian Empire, since the 17th century. And many Ukrainians look towards Poland and the Polish experience after the end of the Cold War. Poland, in effect, became independent of Russia, you know, as a satellite, a vassal, as it were, in 1989. But the Ukrainians noticed that at the time of the Soviet breakup in 1991, Poles and Ukrainians had about the same standard of living, or at least the same, you know, per capita GDP. Since then, the Polish economy has westernized, and it's tripled its GDP per person relative to Ukrainians. So for the Ukrainians, mostly Ukrainians, it's a matter of basics, you know, a job, a paycheck, you know, and a better standard of living. And they look at the Poles and say, look, if we'd done what the Poles did, instead of screwing around trying to be nice to the Russians, or at least keep the Russians from, you know, attacking us or whatever, and immediately gone, you know, and joined Europe and basically done the hard things that the Poles did, that everybody in Eastern Europe had to do in order to convert their economy from a communist-style command economy to a market economy, we'd be doing much better now. And they're basically saying, you know, it's not too late. We got to do it. And the problem is the Russians don't want to lose Ukraine. It's an emotional thing. They still feel that Ukraine is part of Russia. The Ukrainians don't feel the same. Well, you know, it's like a messy divorce. A forced marriage in the first place, and then a divorce, and of course the husband, so to speak, you know, the fatherland, just doesn't want to let go. So it's a domestic dispute, which any cop will tell you is the most dangerous type of dispute to walk into the middle of. For that reason, when the Ukrainians did ask, like you say, in the last 10 years, that's when things really started to bubble, to join NATO, to start the road towards joining the European Union, the Western Europe basically held them off. There was no great enthusiasm because they were afraid of Russia. Russia made it be known, we will not look upon you guys, you know, absorbing Ukraine. I mean, the Russians see, you know, it as a huge Western plot that the NATO is invading Ukraine and moving their armies one step closer to the motherland. It's just a different mentality. The Ukrainians think West. The Russians think God knows where, but it's not West. And that's the basic problem everybody's having to deal with now.
Right. Austin, you wrote a On Point article this week on the really recent history, just within the last a year or 2 years of what's gone on there with Ukraine, with the switch of prime ministers and what's going on right now. You want to enlighten us further on that?
Well, Dan, to set up what happened in the what has happened in the last 2 years, I also did a quick historical sketch, and it's really relevant to what Jim just said, talking about particularly Western Ukraine. Look. Ukraine is you know, some political scientists use the term cleft country for a country that has a historical split. There are other other terms, fractured, but you know, cleft like a rock that has been cleft. And sometimes there's a discussion of Turkey is used as an example, the difference between Eastern Anatolia and Thrace. There are historical and economic and in some cases demographic differences. Ukraine, Western Ukraine, tended to be Catholic. Eastern Ukraine tended to be Eastern Orthodox or Russian Orthodox. And there, that is had a millennium of 800, 900 years, getting close to it, of cultural effects, even prior to communism. Poles are overwhelmingly Catholic, and you have that. You know, it's Catholic Slavs in Western Ukraine, you know, Catholic Slavs in Poland. So you have that connection, and I made that in a paragraph, made that clear, and also talked about the understanding some of the orientation of Ukrainians and Russians living in what is now Eastern Ukraine. So you had that. Now, that it has real connection to the domestic political turmoil. First of all, Yulia Tymoshenko, who's often called that Ukrainian blonde, she's a remarkable political personality. She was prime minister under the prior regime, which was a pro-European Union, Western democratic model. Government. They did not resolve the essential issue that Jim brought up, which is economic development. And yes, they do see Poland as a model, but they were open to the European Union because they see that as a way to get out of the economic stagnation and economic decline that they have experienced. But the government that Tymoshenko was part of did not succeed. That brought in Viktor Yanukovych, who is Putin's puppet, as I called him. He really is very much a Moscow's man in Kiev, and he won a very tight election. He didn't win a majority. Actually, almost 5% of the vote in the 2010 election, Dan, went to none of the above. I kid you not. That was on the ballot. We don't want any of these politicians. Got about 5% of the vote. But he beat Tymoshenko, even though Tymoshenko, and I included this in the article. I mean, it is up on Strategy Page, that there was good evidence on Tymoshenko's part that 900,000 ballots, most of them from Eastern Ukraine, were tainted. She couldn't prove it, but she lost. She lost the presidency. Well, over the last 2 years, you have seen some of the policies that the previous pro-European government had advocated come to naught. Among them included an association agreement with the European Union, which, as Jim said, you talked about the Russian view that NATO's moving east. They see the European Union as NATO. Jim often talks about it as the Franks, France, and German, Franco-German economic advance. Even though, they also know that the Eastern Europeans resented the Russian Empire, and they look at the Russians know that Poland has been a success once it shed the communist chains. They know at some level that it's there's a genuine appeal. So it's not just they're sitting there paranoid and afraid. They also are jealous and resentful of of Western European success. But the Yanukovych takes over and reneges last fall. This is really what initiated the so-called Euromaidan demonstrations, and that had to deal with a pro-European Union. There's a, I believe it refers to actually a square in Kiev where they began to launch the daily public protest after Yanukovych's government reneged on the association agreement. Now, there were he was also resentful of EU criticism and the evidence for what he had done to Tymoshenko. It was he had her tried on really what were trumped up charges. I mean, it's right out of Putin's playbook regarding her signing when she was prime minister. What was really a rotten natural gas deal with Russia. However, the Ukraine felt that and at the time there was a lot of pressure to agree to this because Russia is their source of natural gas. See, this from the Russian perspective of their empire or their association with Ukraine, they say, well, it's logical Ukraine and Russia would be the same country. You've got the agriculture and we've got the energy resources, see? But the that's a Kremlin view. But she signed this agreement, and now after he became president, he said, well, this is ripping off our country, adding up debt. Of course, here he is. He's pro-Putin, you know. So he had her... He trumped up charges, kangaroo court, put her in jail, and she got beaten by prison guards. And I think the evidence of this is pretty overwhelming. She was freed, by the way, last week as soon as President Yanukovych fled Kiev. So European Union human rights activists were pounding on him for that. Also, NATO made a decision, and a complicated decision, and I wrote a column about this, Dan. It actually showed up on some other places on Strategy Page. I do think it's significant to the things that begin to happen last fall. Early October, NATO decides to table Ukraine's request to become, you know, partnership for peace equivalent, you know, the association track to join NATO, which is what the European Unionists and the Westerners wanted. Of course, Putin wanted that table, and it's, I think, in retrospect, it's seen as an act of appeasement. It was, because you had all these other issues boiling on. But when his Yanukovych's government reneges on the EU association in November, the Euromaidan demonstrations start. They're relentless. At the same time, the economic the bills are coming due. Ukraine needs anywhere between 25 and 35 billion. All the figures are in there. I use the higher figure in my column to just meet basic government obligations through the end of 2015. They don't have the money. Putin was going to give them $15 billion. Where that was coming from, who knows? But and what the deal was with that. Anyway, the demonstrations got increasingly violent. There was an attempt by Yanukovych to repress them. Army stayed in the barracks. He found that he had limited reliability from some of the security police, and when at least 100 people were killed, it found out that even any of the eastern Ukrainians rejected the repression. And so Parliament voted for him to resign. I'm not quite sure how that works, because he is elected. You know, he's not elected, he's not a prime minister, he's president. But he... fled Kiev after claiming that he wasn't gonna do so, and then now the latest thing is, where is Yanukovych? Is he in Crimea? Is he in Moscow? I included in my column a little bit of a humor on because the British betting line in it, the British gamblers have a you can bet on where he's gone to hide. You know, that's crazy, but that's what they do. I use that as a way to talk about some of the geographic issues and cultural issues in Ukraine and Russia, because hiding out in Sevastopol and Crimea or in the Donetsk basin. Donetsk is in eastern Ukraine, and it's heavily Russified. As a matter of fact, Yanukovych was governor of that Donetsk region, and those were the British betters regarded those as likely places where he'd gone to hide.
Now, Jim, what is the things are starting to fracture a little bit inside the Ukraine, right? We've got some stuff happening today in Crimea. There's some issues over in the eastern Ukraine. So what is the current situation there?
There's no agreement on what to do next. The people in the Maidan, by the way, in Russian Slavic means square or plaza. The people in the camp, the Maidan, the Euro camp, are basically saying we want real reform. In other words, what they see happening is what happened in Egypt and what happens in a lot of countries where there's a quote-unquote revolution. They basically, the powers that be, you know, the people with the money, the power, you know, the families, as is the case in many Latin American countries, they say the top guy's got to go. We'll basically fire, maybe even kill, you know, as many as we have to, as long as they don't come after us. And the problem in the Ukraine is you do have oligarchs. You do have, you know, government bureaucracies which have a lot of money and power. And there's a lot of corruption. And basically the demonstrators said, look, we did this in the middle of winter. over 100 of us got killed. You know, 1,000 people were, you know, banged up, injured. Many went to jail. Why stop until we actually have something that satisfies? And exactly what that is, nobody can say. Now, the economy minister, I believe, who's down, the temporary, you know, prime minister, he's saying we're interim, we're going to hold elections, but they haven't scheduled elections yet. And different parts of the country have different ideas. As Austin pointed out, you know, the eastern Ukraine, which, like the Crimea, was not part of the original Ukraine, you know, what we call Western Ukraine. These were areas that were basically conquered by the Russian Empire after they had absorbed Ukraine. That's why many Russians call, like especially Crimea, Russian. It was a Russian, not a Ukrainian conquest. And even the even a lot of Ukrainians will say, well, yeah, technically. But these things have a tendency to spiral out of control, and that's what everybody is trying to avoid right now. They're trying to work out some way where they can basically come to an understanding for elections, for maybe a constitutional assembly, you know, to write a new constitution. One thing most Ukrainians can agree on, we need a change. You know, we can't keep going the way we've been going. And this is going to annoy the Russians a great deal, but that means basically making a clean break with Russia. And, of course, Russia doesn't want that. And Russia will interfere as much as it can to try and make sure that does not happen. So the situation is, as they say, smooth.
Now, Jim, you wrote at the end of last year, you wrote something about how fracking is going to help the Ukraine out.
Is that right? Yes. Ukraine has, they have fracking resources, and that is still tied up in Parliament. But that's one thing a lot of people are saying. You know, we have hydrocarbon natural resources. We just have to start going. But see, that takes money. You know, the reason the United States went, made so much progress with fracking is not just because it was invented here, but because the capital was ready and available, you know, to basically deploy, you know, billions of dollars, thousands of people, you know, all sorts of equipment and what have you, to make it happen. And it's happening, and it happened in Canada, because Canada basically has the same, you know, those deposits. They have tar sands and a similar situation in Canada. And similar situation in Central Europe. Actually, similar situation in many parts of Europe. But in most of Western Europe, there are laws you know, the law in North America, especially in the United States, favors, you know, exploitation of mineral resources, because in many European countries, the state, you know, there's no easy way for an entrepreneur to get access to the material underneath, you know, the natural resources, especially something like, you know, using hydrofracking. And of course, there's a lot of people who have a knee jerk, you know, oh, it hurts the atmosphere, the climate, et cetera, et cetera. You don't have that problem in Ukraine because they have no hydrocarbons. They have no coal. Well, they do have coal in eastern Ukraine, but the Russians basically have dibs on that if they have their way. They have no natural gas. And of course, they have brutal winters, you know, very similar to Canada. So it's very popular, the idea of getting fracking, but they got to get money to do it from somebody. Now, the Russians aren't going to do it. The Russians just recently, in the last few months, admitted, you know, there might be something to this fracking. Now they're talking about fracking themselves. But they don't really have to because they have a lot of, you know, natural gas deposits in the ground. But Ukraine is in a different situation. If they stick with the Russians, they'll never get the frack. It will get fracked, so to speak.
Right, yeah, that was the joke that was coming to my mind. Was
you frack or get frack? A good title for this piece. But if they go west, even if the Europeans don't invest, although I know what European investment bankers are more than happy to invest in fracking wherever they can. They just can't do it in their own countries, at least not yet. But the capital will pour in, so to speak, and get that, and you'll have a fracking boom. And in 5 years, you know, Ukraine will start losing that dependence on Russia for natural gas. The Russians don't want that. That's why, you know, the U.S. government, even though it blew its credibility by not following up on the threat to bomb Syria if they use chemical weapons, but what little clout we have, what little credibility we have, it being now thrown at Russia, say, do not invade Ukraine. Now, I don't know what's being, I don't have as many contacts in the State Department as I used to. I don't know what's being said, you know, beneath closed doors, out of earshot, as it were. But I expect if something is said, it's to the it's along the lines that we are serious. You know, we're not going to give up Ukraine because there's a large Ukrainian population, well, significant Ukrainian population in the United States, and they're basically saying, remember what happened to Poland in 1939. Let's not do it again. Because that's how the Ukrainians see themselves. They see themselves as a bastion of Western civilization, you know, on the borders of, you know, barbarity, which is what they consider the Russians. So they're representatives of the rebels, so to speak, the reformers, are basically telling anybody who will listen to them in the United States, don't let us be Polandized, as it were. The question is, will we let them get basically sucked back into the Russian Empire, or will a way be found to let Ukraine be, you know, what it always wanted to be, a free, independent, and prosperous state? The question is still up in the air.
Austin, Jim brings up the thing that I sort of wanted to end the discussion with, and that's as we see Russia strengthening their position in the world, we see the United States withdrawing. We've announced that we're going to draw down our forces. We've had the bungling in Syria. We've seen to be withdrawing from a number of different places. Russia announced the other day that they're looking for overseas naval bases. We've been closing down overseas naval bases. How is the geopolitical ramifications of Ukraine playing out in all of this?
Well, that's a tough question. I note in the article that I, unlike some of the commentary that I read over the weekend, I'm talking about my initial commentary last Sunday and Monday, and realized I wrote my column on Tuesday, and today's the 27th, so I wrote it on the 25th of February. That,
yes.
But I called it a long-term struggle. A long-term tug of war, because a tug of war of the orientation of Ukraine has been going on for could say several hundred years. It's not going to end soon. Jim has given a number of the historical, and I'll call them the psychological, political connections that the Russians have with Ukraine. We both, when I brought up Rubik, Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, Kazakhstan, and I mentioned that in the column, that actually shows up in the 1992 post-Cold War edition of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War, Dan. I mean, because that is, if you have Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Kazakhstan, you have the basis of a superpower. You have the agriculture, the population and presence and the resources to be a superpower. And don't think Vladimir Putin's not aware of that. He is. It's not just him. Kremlin's aware of, but so are Ukrainians, which is why they know they're desired by Moscow. And that's I'm sure the Kazakhs are aware that of that as well. So there is that, and I'm giving you really a kind of a deep strategic answer to your question. How's it going to play out? Well, over the short term, that's why I said the Red Army hasn't. the Russian Army. a little historical slip there. The Russian Army has not yet invaded Ukraine, even though. As Jim pointed out, and you pointed out, that the Russian Army is holding exercises on the Russian-Ukraine border. That's at 150,000 troops. Ukrainian military has so far stayed in the barracks. We haven't seen a demand, and this is the way I put it at the time when I wrote it a couple of days ago, demand among Eastern Ukrainians that Yanukovych be returned to power. But we are seeing in Crimea, as you mentioned, and as Jim mentioned, pro-Moscow, ethnic Russian predominantly groups saying we object to Ukrainians, Western Ukrainians, or Ukrainian fascists is what they tend to call them. Ukrainian Nazis is what the Russian groups refer to them as. Driving the elected our elected president out, and we have a long term relationship with Russia. And so there are these pockets, just like in Transnistria, that in Moldova that have. That are reacting to domestically in Ukraine. You can't predict what they're going to do in the short run, other than you can say these kind of groups are going to crop up. They're going to make demands. The question is are they going to coalesce? What's the Kremlin going to do? And then you ask, and the way you set the question up, you said, well, the Russians are being aggressive and talking aggressive. Take a look, Dan, over the last 20 years, even in their worst moments of their military falling apart, they always talked aggressive. Your question, and Jim has also the analysis that he has in How to Make War section of the strategy page. The Russians still have huge military problems, and reconstituting force and being able to project power. That said, NATO is in something of a retrenchment phase right now. I think that's part of the reason the decision last October was reached, because if you put Ukraine on track to join NATO, which It may ultimately happen, because as Jim pointed out, the Ukrainian demand, don't let us be Poland 1939. On the other side, they want to be Poland 2014. Remember that. That's the current Poland's their model, but not 1939 with the being divided between Soviet Union, Stalin, and the Hitler's Third Reich. They don't want to be absorbed in that. But the NATO, if you become part of NATO, Article 5, the Three Musketeer article, which is if your border's attacked, everybody's committed. If you're crossed, everybody's committed to your defense. All for one and one for all. NATO lacks conventional power. They can do a job of protecting Poland, probably Romania and Bulgaria, and like this. But Ukraine is deep in that's deeper. And there's a problem with it. I think some of that had to go into NATO's decision. So it's not only whether U.S. retrenchment, implicitly questioned current U.S. Will, and you brought up Syria, and Jim mentioned red line, and, you know, that's U.S. is paying a diplomatic and political price for the failure to back up the red line commitment on use of chemical weapons in Syria. Putin paid attention to that. The whole world, a world of bad guys, paid attention to that failure. But Ukraine has it may be a country too far, Dan, for providing Western defense. That said, Russia's not really in premier position to attack Ukraine either. Ukraine is not Georgia. Russia went to war in Georgia, a limited war, in 2008. And I'm not saying they won't do it. I wrote that they could. But the situation is very, very dicey from both sides. From both sides. Most likely there's going to be Russian demands for security, and I could see this, peacekeeping forces to protect ethnic Russians and using something along the lines of the Transdniester example. I think we'll see that. Will it happen? I don't know.
Yeah. Final question, Jim, to wrap this all up. I saw this morning that Anders Fogh Rasmussen, who is the Secretary General of NATO, at least gave a tepid warning. I've actually met Mr. Rasmussen. I've had dinner with him once because of my connections with Denmark. But he actually gave a tepid warning this morning to Russia to back off. How is NATO going to react to all of this? Or is that all we're going to hear is the Secretary General of NATO giving a warning, but with them basically being not able to do anything in the situation?
Western Europe has a different relationship with Russia than the United States does. Western Europe gets a lot of its natural gas from Russia via a pipeline which goes through Ukraine. Also, Western Europe does a lot more trade with Russia than the United States does. So the Europeans are much less, much more reluctant to offend Russia, to get Russia angry at Europe. Being angry at the United States, no problem. Being angry at Ukraine, not much of a problem. But don't point the death threat at us. So that's why Western Europe, for 20 years now, ever since Ukraine became independent, has been reluctant to do anything with Ukraine that would offend Russia. Now, as I pointed out earlier, I've had European investment bankers tell me, you know, if the Ukrainians are free to frack, you know, European money will be there, you know, to finance it, you know, get a piece of the action. But it's European governments who are worrying about the big picture and, you know, long-term relationships with Russia. They are not as enthusiastic. This annoys the heck out of the Ukrainians, which is why the Ukrainians put so much pressure on the United States. There are Ukrainians living in the United States, especially here in New York City. They feel that, you know, the United States has gone out of its way to defend liberty and democracy in Western Europe. Well, how about a little of that joy, you know, right here in the Black Earth country of Ukraine? And right now, the United States is going through the motions, but, you know, there's a lot of, you know, our current, you know, administration is really wants to back out of foreign entanglements, and Ukraine wants one.
Well, I guess to end it all, like we sort of mentioned before, we're just going to have to see who gets fracked in this situation. And
fracked
usually it's
or be
the,
fracked.
The little guy.
Exactly.
What?
Dan, let me add one point about that. Jim has written about it. Fracking's coming up. Maybe we should do a podcast on the implications, strategic implications of that. I mean, it is written a great deal about, but the Russians are aware. They know that Holland, Great Britain, Ukraine, Take a look at the basin maps, potentially Germany, right on up into Scandinavia, that there are these, you know, tight natural gas deposits that could be fracked. They also know that the Russians have significant, maybe the largest tight gas formation on the planet out in Siberia. Eventually, it's going to be tapped. But if Western Europe is producing its own gas, they lose a political lever, you know, which is
right. Yeah, and that's a big one right now. So that it is going to play out and be really interesting. You know, we're back in the world of the geopolitics of World War One and post World War One in some degree, aren't we, Austin?
Well, this is feeding me a softball, and we, you know, we're trying to wind this up. But I tell you, World War One isn't over, Dan, and I've said that many times. It's just not over.
Right. Yeah, and just so that our listeners know, we're going through and covering World War One in a lot of detail over the next few months.
Yeah,
our
critics tell us we're doing it in too much detail, but that's
well, somebody needs to do it though. we if not us, who? If not now, when? Right.
All right.
All right. Well, that wraps it up, gentlemen, and we'll talk to you next time.
All right.